The spirit of performance defines Acura. And now, it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Powell's predicament. The Fed seemingly missed the surge inflation on the way up. And now the question is, are they going to get it wrong on the way down? The market impact of the chair's next move straight ahead. Plus, an ugly day for Ulta shares, tumbling over 15% as the company warns that demand is slowing in the first quarter. Is this yet another sign the consumer is nearly tapped out? We'll debate that. And later, tuning in to why Spotify is surging, Ford's revved up quarter for hybrids and EVs, and what happens at Disney now that Bob Iger won the big proxy battle against Nelson Peltz. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Guy Adami. We start off with the Fed Chair Powell's balancing act, the central bank chief towing the line between spurring economic growth by cutting rates and tamping down on persistently high inflation. Earlier today, Powell suggested he is not yet ready to say that battle's been won.
On inflation, it is too soon to say whether the recent readings represent more than just a bump. We do not expect that it will be appropriate to lower our policy rate until we have greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably down toward 2%.
The Fed's key inflation gauge has now been above its target 2% rate for three straight years. It's not exactly as transitory as Powell originally said it would be, and that sparks our question tonight. Will the Fed be as wrong on inflation on the way down as it was on the way up? Some other, you know, interesting things that he said today. He thought monetary policy was tight. I thought that was interesting because I don't know what he's looking at.
Well, I don't know what it meant. Yeah, I don't know what lens he's looking through to come up with that. But I'll say this. Can they be as wrong? Well, I mean, this was a Fed, by the way, that says we're not even thinking about cutting rates way back in the day, if you recall, or raising rates. Back in the day, that proved to be completely wrong. So I don't think it's possible to be that wrong again. With that said, I'll give him credit. I think he's trying to toe the line here, and I think he understands that inflation is a problem. Forget about gold for a second, which is its own animal. But, you know, through the lens of soft commodities, we brought up the DBA. I get it. A lot of it's cocoa, but that's been off to the races. Freeport-McMoRan, throw a chart up there, FCX. Copper's been off to the races. That's making like a three-year high in terms of that stock. And obviously, energy and the refiners continue to grind higher. So the inflation battle's far from over.
Yeah. Tim, what do you think?
It's interesting because interest rates and the dollar are struggling with what the Fed's got to do. But everything else is telling you that the Fed has inflation still to deal with and there's nothing that they can do. So as Guy said, look at the commodities. Look at the CRB, whatever measure of the Commodity Research Bureau indices. There's a number of them that you want to read. No matter what you look at, we're somewhere between 50 and 65% above where we were pre-COVID in terms of core commodities. Gold has had a huge run. That's all we do. It's all we talk about. But look at uranium. Look at all the other, the kind of world is coming to an end plays. And all the folks that have been saying it's going to happen, that's the place that at least I think you're seeing a lot of really interesting price action. So if you look at Fed Fund futures at this point, Dan mentioned this yesterday, it's pretty much priced out. You're at 523 right now in June. You're at 517 in July. And you're around 507 in August. So that kind of tells you what the market is saying in terms of the Fed that really can't cut. We've said no cuts. I think Guy said yesterday, not a bad thing for the economy if that's truly the state of where we are. But right now, I'm not sure that the Fed, back to your question, are they going to screw it up on the way down? I don't think they can. And if we actually, because there's
you don't
no
think they can, meaning they cannot afford to, as opposed to they cannot.
I'm saying that's a good point. I think that they can probably do it, but I think they're better off erring on the side of making sure that the inflation genie gets as much stuff back into that bottle as they can. can, because this is a genie they started way back in 2008, if not probably, you know, somewhere in 2002 or three.
And he also talked about how detrimental it would be if inflation actually did. Mm-hmm. How it wasn't just a bump and it was a more sustainable rise.
Right. It's become embedded in wages. I mean, we're going to get a good read on some of that on Friday morning. But I'll just say this. I think the most important thing that's probably happened in the last, call it 4 months or so, is at mid-December, the Fed said they were expecting 1.4% GDP growth for 2024. And in mid-March, they said they're expecting 2.1%, which really kind of signals to some degree how they've changed their views about the strength of the economy and what they might do with policy to counterbalance what's a weakening economy. Because you could say, okay, the inflationary forces, a higher dollar, a higher commodities, higher interest rates, those are things that are going to basically weigh on growth or the potential for earnings growth in the near term if you want to bring it back to the stock market. But to me, I don't think there's any rush to do anything on the policy front right now, as long as things seem this stable. And we're going to get earnings and we're going to get Q2 guidance in the not so distant future here. And that might really reinforce all of this sort of stuff. And so to Tim's point about 5.23, what's being priced in by Fed fund futures, that might start ticking up. I mean, like you might see cuts go out the window, and then you might say, when do they have to start raising? But if GDP growth is accelerating, then that's fine, I guess, because look what's happened with rates over the last, you know, in the stock market over the last, year and a half, they've kind of moved together pretty well.
Mm-hmm. I agree with all the gentlemen here. I think that
Do you think she knows our names?
Panelists.
I went with gentlemen. Okay. I think that if you weigh the balance of doing one thing or the other, the downside of going too early, so far outweighs maybe we should have done it a 3 months ago or so. I don't understand why I don't know that he feels a need to talk somewhat dovish sometimes. I don't understand why they would need to do this. I think that to have made the mistake on the way up, why would you, get out potentially not when the job is done? It doesn't make sense to me.
Do you think that enters his mind? Do you think that there is a mind game that the Fed is playing with the markets in terms of, trotting out all these Fed speakers and saying, we should sound dovish?
Well, can I just add one thing?
I don't know what the game plan would be there.
This morning, was it Bostic?
Yeah.
Who was very,
he said one. Basically.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Right. So
Can I make one point here? And if you look back over the last 25 years, though, think back to 2001, think about 2007, 2008, and then think about, 2020. It was actually an unforeseen sort of thing. And if you think about, those were the three worst market periods that we've had. And they also corresponded with the Fed basically getting about as easy as you can possibly get. And so I don't have an answer. And I'm not obviously hope that nothing remotely happens, anything similar. But at some point, it's the thing that you can't see. We spend a lot of time sitting here talking about this number and that number and what this could mean and that. And again, we don't know, but there does seem to be always something lurking out there that causes them to make a big move lower. And obviously they stair step it higher. So I think the potential for a mistake, to me, probably lies exactly what Karen just said. Why go early when everything seems to be okay on autopilot right now?
If it was as simple as calling markets too. I mean, I think if you came into 24, what were the biggest, I go back to this Bank of America fund manager survey that I participate in on a monthly basis. One of the questions is always, what are the things that you're most worried about? Is it Fed risk? Is it? And they're usually big macro kind of tail risks. Geopolitical is the part of this that I think is what a lot of these asset classes are telling us. And it's not just, U.S., China. It's not Russia, Ukraine. It's all of it. It's xenophobia. It's essentially a pullback and onshoring. And it's certainly a political cycle, not just in this country, but the one in this country as it is for almost everything else, both in terms of the markets and in terms of sectors, in terms of companies. It's going to be a lot bigger and a lot more powerful. And I think that's what a lot of the market dynamic is telling you right now. And we're not going to know.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Ukraine, you mentioned China. But yes, U.S. in terms of the elections, but also how the elections will then impact geopolitics.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
You have two different things that you have to handicap in order to get the outcome. And that's even harder to do.
And then you have the political weight or the political pressures being put on. Without question, I mean, Jerome Powell, we talked about it a couple of weeks ago. Senator Warren and Senator Sanders writing him an open letter basically saying you have to cut rates and you have to do it in a meaningful way very quickly because people are hurting with rates this high. But, that might be politically expedient. It's the absolute worst thing they could possibly do because the people they're trying to help are going to be the ones that are hurt the most by that, as counterintuitive as that is, because inflation is what's killing people. And if you think What are you talking about? The reason why, if all the economy was the stock market, Biden's approval rating would be 75-80%, if not higher. It's historically low. So clearly the market has nothing to do with it. It's about people paying too much for things and they're feeling the pain.
All right. For more on the Fed's inflation battle, let's bring in CNBC's Rick Santelli, who is at the CME in Chicago. So, Rick, this is the question we started the show with. Is Powell getting inflation wrong on the way down?
You know, this group, whether it's Tim, Dan, Guy, you guys nailed it in the opening. And Karen, I'll answer your question. Why? Why does he err on sounding like a dove? And everybody knows he does. He's painted himself into the corner all by himself. Why? To goose stocks. They're playing this game. And I'm not saying it's a bad game. Maybe that's exactly what Fed guidance should be. To try to stroke the markets, not to get too ugly and kind of keep everybody alive as to what the Fed may or may not do. But ultimately, what I heard today, finally from the chairman, is the same thing that you've been discussing. It's not quite soup yet. And if he goes early and ends up with a 70s-style resurgence in inflation, all is lost. And I think their credibility is already in question. With a seven-plus trillion balance sheet, there's not much room for error. How much more could they stimulate if they get it wrong with inflation? And I'll just go in one direction here. Just the state of California alone, what they're mandating with bottom of the food chain, trucking, how they're trying to upend that industry, that's not going to end well. Us old people remember Beta versus VHS. Whether it's fossil fuel or EV, we're going to end up with both standards being more expensive because nobody's ready. And just look to Europe. They were in for a pence, in for a pound. They're trying to extricate themselves from all of these EV mandates. That alone will make sure inflation isn't going to be slain. And even if it gets to 2%, it's going to bounce up again. I just don't see how it can't.
I think that's interesting. You're talking about policy-induced inflation, and we've talked about it with nearshoring, but, you know, obviously what we saw in terms of, you mentioned California, the wage increases for minimum wage fast food workers, that's really going to hurt, and we're going to start hearing about that in this next quarter. But, Rick, I also wanted to discuss the Friday's jobs report. Everybody's looking to that, but you say those numbers are a little bit more complicated because of the immigration factor.
Yes, you know, oh, my goodness. Just consider this. You know, Paul today was talking about climate change. Why? Because he sees he's getting painted into another corner to be an active person, entity with regard to what happens with climate change. But he's going to be even more in the corner with things like immigration, because if you consider the fact that the demographics of the country augur that good immigration is highly needed, and all of a sudden in an election year, in the last 3 or 4 weeks, when I see the two biggest planks going into November are the economy, which is really inflation, and the other one that keeps showing up is immigration. But the problem is, saying immigration is good is a great thing. But there's two types of immigration. There's the good immigration where we have good records and we have some quality skills coming in. Then there's the type of immigration on the southern border. That's a huge dynamic in the election. Draw your own conclusions. But when I see leisure and hospitality and I see those jobs moving up and I see the immigration story, I get it. But what? Maybe 10% of the immigration is going to go into that mode, the one on the southern border now. But the other 80 or 90%, what's the cost benefit to society? How much is it costing to do what we're doing on the border? How much is it costing when we look at the drugs coming in? How much is it costing for the social services and the entitlements, which, by the way, are fueling the very GDP that the Fed chairman has to contend with when he's deciding what to do with rates? Very complicated. Immigration is going to be a real hot button if the Fed keeps talking about it in terms of jobs when it's such a big platform going into November.
Hey, Rick, I love the passion and agree. And in fact, you know, immigration and the border is now, I think, a bipartisan issue and something, you know, we all think about. And I'll tell you, I guess I go right back to you, who are the guru of bonds, a guy that stands in the pits every day and certainly in some of its heyday. Where are rates going? Because you know, ultimately, the 2-year trend on the long end is higher. Everything that people want to believe in terms of what the Fed and what they have to cut for tells you they should go lower. And is it a little bit of both and sequencing on that, please, if you can?
I think a little bit of both is the answer. Hence, it's a steepening yield curve trade, in my opinion. I think the short end is going to be massaged ultimately lower. It was the one maturity yesterday that didn't close above its high yield closes for 2024. But I think the long end is going to have to contend with so much. I mean, just on the deficit side alone, some of these numbers are so underestimated what's coming down the pipe with regard to deficits in issuance that I ultimately think the long end, we could call it, you know, that anecdotal of vigilantes, but in the end, it is unsustainable. Einhorn said it today. All the big institutional traders recognize what's going on. And ultimately, Tim, I think it's going to be the unraveling of the longer maturities and the steepening of the yield curve and the presence of stagflation that's all going to be grouped together.
Rick, always great to get your take. Appreciate the time. Rick Santelli joining us from Chicago. Karen, what's your trade on TLT these days?
Well, I covered some. It's moved a lot, although, you know, listening to Rick, maybe I was just thinking about it as he was talking. All right, well, do I want to be completely out? No, probably. But, you know, we could get a little bit of cool data. It would move a lot. I think we're more likely to see hot data, so that would bode for staying in it. But now I have like a half position, so I don't know what I wish for in terms of that trade.
When Karen saw about staying in it, just so staying short.
It's important for people
to understand
correct.
That.
And so I think that trade says yields will go higher.
Yep.
Which I happen to agree with. I know Tim's been in that camp for a while. That's not what the market's prepared for. I don't believe that, you know, yields which close say I think 10-year 4.35 or. You know, if they head back to 4.75, what does that mean for the broader market? I don't think it's particularly encouraging.
Well, look at yesterday in the S&P 500. Okay, so we're down a little less than 1% today. We didn't get a whole heck of a lot of that back. And if you look at that uptrend that's been in place from the October lows, maybe they could throw that up here. I mean, yesterday's gap lower and the close was below that uptrend that's been in place since late October. I think that's nearly, what, 28, 29% off of those lows. And just from a technical perspective, if you think that the 10-year yield, if that number at 4.5 or something is the one that like alarm bells go off a little bit. I mean, we are so much higher in the S&P than where we were the last time that we were at 4.5% on the 10-year. If you go back to September or so, I think we were 4,600 or something like that. So at some point, I mean, somebody's going to care about some of this stuff when it all comes together with a dollar that's pretty stuck here at higher levels, crude oil that's in the mid 80s, you know, yields where, you know, it seems that the pressure is higher based on what's going on, whether it be reshoring, whether it be China reawakening, whether it be just some things going on in the soft commodities. So to me, I get it. The only piece of the puzzle here that doesn't make a lot of sense right now is the S&P 500, 5,200.
Yep. Turning now to the battle for Paramount, the entertainment giant soaring as much as 17% today on the news that the board will enter exclusive merger talks with media company Skydance. That after Apollo Global offered $26 billion in cash for the entire company over the weekend. For more, let's bring in Lightshed Partners, Rich Greenfield. Rich, great to have you with us.
This is wild, Melissa. This is really wild.
Why?
Well, because there supposedly is a $26 billion bid. You would presume that would be an all-cash bid for the company. Yet, if it was a cash bid, why was it turned down in favor of essentially a merger of Skydance into Paramount? It doesn't make a lot of sense. Because if you're thinking about this from a Paramount shareholder standpoint, remember, what happened to Paramount this morning? If you go back, if you pull up the chart and you look at Paramount, the stock was down this morning because shareholders were looking at a transaction that actually was immediately good for Shari Redstone and the National Amusements owners because it was going to take them out. But then it was actually going to dilute Paramount by including Skydance or merging Skydance into Paramount. And so the stock was actually down on that transaction, the sort of exclusive negotiating decision that they made, the stock was down. Then the stock soared on a bid that wasn't accepted, assuming it was real and fully financed, that they excluded that bid. And so everyone's just trying to understand, investors are sort of baffled. How could you say no to a cash bid and pursue this alternative transaction for the next 30 days? Something doesn't add up. It just doesn't make sense to me or to any of the investors I'm talking to.
What is your intuition? I mean, you've been following the company for a long time. What do you think is going on, you know, behind the scenes and in particular with National Amusement and Shari Redstone?
Look, there's no doubt that National Amusement has made it pretty clear. The Redstone family made it pretty clear that they want out. Like, they want to monetize their stake. I think they see the challenges facing the media universe, and they're certainly looking for the best option. It's surprising that if this Apollo bid was real, it's surprising they didn't take it. I can't really give you a good answer of why you would say no, unless it isn't as, you know, again, it wasn't, we don't have the, what were they paying per share? All we have is this sort of $26 billion enterprise that was in the Wall Street Journal earlier today. Maybe there's more to this than meets the eye. I don't know. Obviously, there's regulatory approval you would need because Apollo obviously already owns TV stations. Not that I think it's a huge problem, but you would need FCC approval for that transaction. I don't think the Skydance merger would have any issues whatsoever from a regulatory standpoint.
Hey, Rich, it's Tim. So help us understand the sum of the parts of this. And because I think it also feeds into other plays within media right now. Now, we all know in media, some of the parts doesn't add up to what the holding company is worth. Time Warner, one of the great, great examples of just destroyed value. But Apollo started with an $11 billion bid for just TV and studio. So that gives you some baseline. And yet the stock, in terms of market cap, at the end of that day and even for a week following, traded, you know, around $8.5 billion. So what should this tell investors who are looking at media assets, understand that private equity is looking at media assets, and understanding that there could be some, you know, some come-to-value moment here for some of this stuff?
Well, Tim, I got to correct you just to be clear. It was when you say $11 billion, that was for the studio. But remember, Paramount, while its market cap was $8 billion, its enterprise value was $20 billion. It's got $12, $13 billion of debt. And so that was they were only buying a piece of Paramount. And so it makes sense why the stock didn't react strongly on that just acquisition of the studio. Obviously, there's taxes to pay. And then you're left with sort of a, you know, very challenge TV business if you sell off the sort of the crown jewel, which is not just the film studio, but selling the TV studio. That is really a valuable asset that was being sold in that transaction. So I can understand if I'm sitting in National Amusement shoes, I can understand why I don't want to sell the studio. First of all, it doesn't get me cash. It just gets the company in better position, but it doesn't cash out National Amusements. The shift from buying just a piece of the company, assuming this $26 billion bid is real, that's where you start to, that's where the real head scratcher comes in, is like, how could you say no to that? If that offer came in over the weekend, why would that not be more attractive than pursuing a pretty complicated transaction that's probably going to end up with a lot of litigation because you're basically only taking out for cash one shareholder?
Rich, good to see you. Thank you, Rich Greenfield.
Thanks for having me.
Do not miss CNBC's exclusive interview with Bob Iger tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. He'll sit down with David Faber, discuss his proxy battle win over Nelson Peltz in Trian. Didn't even talk to Rich about that, but of course, Disney's also on the docket here for discussion.
100%. We've talked about this. I think you stay long in earnings on the 8th of May or so. But just going back to Paramount real quick, I mean, the price action today was actually interesting. And Rich mentioned it opened, I think, $11.40 or so. And then, obviously, at the end of the day, it was off to the races. It also traded north of 60 million shares. So this might be one of those days where, you know, everything we talked about, but if you're looking to trade from the long side, you might have gotten a little capitulation today in terms of the potential move higher.
So this, it's such an odd situation that we're in. I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up in Delaware court somehow, because how can that one shareholder... But they are, there is control,
yeah.
Right? So this can't be the first time this has happened. But I would think, if I were Apollo, I really wanted to make a tender, put a lot of pressure on them.
Yeah. Coming up, beauty buzzkill, Ulta's ugliest day since 2020 after the company warned of slower growth this year. What it might take for this stock to make up the numbers. Next, Don't go anywhere. Fast Money's back in two.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee. Right here on CNBC.
Hi, I'm Ben Rizzuto, wealth strategist at Janus Henderson Investors. Is a brighter future possible? At Janus Henderson, we think it is. For 90 years, we've worked to help clients achieve superior financial outcomes and fulfill our purpose of investing in a brighter future together. We know that this means our thinking and our investments are helping to shape millions of futures. At Janus Henderson, we are committed to helping you invest in a brighter future for the next 90 years and beyond. To learn more, go to janushenderson.com.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. An ugly day for Ulta Beauty as the stock sees its worst session since the start of the pandemic. The company's CEO warning that demand would cool off in 2024 and that the slowdown would be, quote, a bit earlier and a bit bigger than expected. So what will it take for Ulta to glow up after today's drop? The way they talked about the slowdown, though, was like every category, every price point across all segments, they saw softness.
Well, some more than others, and they had some explanation. It started out perfectly great. Hey, thanks for having us here at the conference, and then a little bit of chit-chat about the business, and then, oh, yeah, we're seeing this big slowdown, and that's sort of when, things just threw up, and a little bit of throw-up got on that Estee Lauder. I'm sorry about that, but this was bad.
Been thrown up on for months now.
Yeah. But this was bad. There was a lot not to like, but the things that they did call out, prestige was particularly weak. They talked about, you know, needing to go up against Sephora and do a little better there. They talked about hair care comps last year. Dyson was huge, and that was a big thing, and people don't buy another one, because they're so expensive, although they had to know that was coming. The interesting thing is that they said we're going to be at the low end of our first quarter guidance. This stock was reacting like it was a failed phase three trial of whatever the new beauty thing is, and it just, I mean, I thought it was overdone. And I didn't listen to my three-day rule, and it was down like 13%. I'm like, this is crazy.
So you bought more?
I bought more, and then it was down another 2%. I'm like, all right, I got to wait a little bit more because now they have a little bit of a credibility problem, I think. And so they had the multiple has come down already considerably, but it's not great. It really was not great. And some of the explanations about, all right, if you do have some revenue growth in the second half, which they talked about, how come you're not going to get to a higher margin? Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this was being conservative after really, you know, right, sort of laying an egg here. They didn't have a great reason why they wouldn't get to it. Like, maybe promotional. Uh-huh. So that could be it. So it was
the contrast, though, with Sephora, how LVMH talked about the Sephora business seemed to be. I mean, Sephora was great, right?
Yeah, Sephora was.
Or LVMH in the latest quarter. And so this is sort of, you know, are they losing out to Sephora at this point?
Well, I think the competitive landscape is brutal, right? Mm-hmm. And it's getting to a place where also the distribution channels are part of the exciting story. There's different tailwinds that are going on here. And I think it's, innovation and beauty, which, you know, I'm sure you ladies can talk about. It's obvious. But I think you get to a place where you look at the sector and you look at the places where you've had extraordinary growth. And Ulta, you know, 3 weeks ago kind of told you that. Then this data point, which I think is since that quarter. In other words, part of what's scary for the sector is it sounds like this is Ulta since they last reported.
This is, yes, February and March for a quarter that's two-thirds of the way over. They end in April, yeah.
Huh.
That's a good point.
So it isn't good. Now, the E in Blicep, which is Estee Lauder, I think they had this priced in 2 years, you know, a year and a half ago. This is part of the story there. That's the difference between Ulta and Estee Lauder to me. It's great that the Blicep comes up every time.
The difference to me, though.
Not a day that goes by without a Blicep.
I think the E in Blicep, that has a China problem that Ulta doesn't have. Ulta is much more U.S.-centric. Right. They're looking to expand that.
Travel retail, you don't think Ulta's exposed to that?
I mean, but
that
I think really for Estee Lauder,
it's a big deal for EO.
Yeah, for duty free for sure. A lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Turn up the volume. Spotify hitting its highest levels in more than 2 years today. The headlines that have investors singing along with the stock. Next. Plus, Ford keeps on trucking. The automaker posting a monster increase in EV sales. The eye-popping numbers that just might put the charge back in the electric auto trade. You're watching Fast Money live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
For more than a decade, Comcast has been committed to bridging the digital divide and connecting millions to affordable high-speed internet. But the barriers to get connected go well beyond affordability. Through Project Up, Comcast is committing $1 billion to reach millions with digital skills training, resources, and opportunities needed to succeed in a digital world. Project Up, building a future of unlimited possibilities. Learn more at comcast.com/projectup.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Spotify topping the tape, surging more than 8% after Bloomberg reported the company plans to hike subscription prices this year. Prices in five countries, including the U.S., will go up by $1 to $2 by the end of April. The one in the U.S. will come later this year. Spotify also reportedly planning to roll out a basic subscription that excludes audiobooks for current premium plan prices of $11 a month. This is the second price increase in the past year.
Yeah, remember we used to spend a lot of time with Netflix on the price increases and the stock would go down and we get really nervous about churn and the like. And now the stock goes up 5% when they announce this, the second one. Like you said, you know, again, if you look at Netflix and you look at their gross margins somewhere above 40% or so, you look at a Spotify, kind of similar sort of businesses below 30%, you look at price increases and you say, well, that's good margin stuff there. If you can continue to do that and continue to add other products. So to me, I think it makes sense why the stock's going up, especially when you look at what expectations for revenue growth and earnings growth are. Better than that of Netflix, it trades more expensive. But if it becomes a story where you can start pricing in higher margins, I think it'll kind of grow into that valuation.
Didn't you say once that Netflix should buy Spotify?
100%. Because think about this.
You still think that?
I think, well, I mean, listen, it's too big of a deal now. Yeah. Like, it's a $56 billion market cap company right now, and it's, you know, it would be 20% right here of just their market cap of Netflix. But I think it makes sense for them to go vertical here and get some of these other products. They could bring those margins up for Spotify probably pretty quickly.
So let's bring it into the trenches and talk about what we all use on the desk. I mean, you guys are big Spotify. I'm Apple Music.
Sure,
and the
are.
Question I pose to the desk is, we never give Apple credit for Apple Music and what it might mean in terms of a revenue source.
Okay.
And yet here we are rewarding Spotify, a company that for a long time wasn't profitable and now has a market cap of $60
billion. It's not lumped into services?
Well, I don't know. It is, but I mean, it's growing, and I think it's Apple and Spotify. Well, maybe it's just because I think it's a much easier service to use, especially with my Sonos, but that's, you know, another story. But I feel as if there are two emerging players in this game, and it reminds me a little bit of the streaming world, as Dan's pointing out. So, guys, Spotify list is a daily conversation on this desk.
Because it's ridiculous.
I think it's open to the public. I think,
it's ridiculous. What kind of person puts a list together of 100 songs?
And he alphabetizes by the first name of the artist, not the last name.
Let's clarify a few things. We have time.
Alice Cooper?
It's 860 songs.
So it's even more ridiculous than I originally thought.
Why is that ridiculous?
It's 8 times more ridiculous.
What's the playing time of the list?
How do you alphabetize?
Over 60 hours, I believe.
Jethro
Tull. Why bother putting together a list if you're going to have 800 songs?
Marshall Tucker, Jethro Tull.
What's not on the list?
I mean, yeah.
It's a much shorter list.
This is a whole other show that nobody will watch.
Let's put the list in the show.
Coming up, Greenlight Capital giving the green light to a couple of investments at this year's Sohn Conference. We'll take a look at some of David Einhorn's best ideas and biggest themes. Plus, Ford motoring higher today as it seems to be gaining ground in the EV race. The eye-popping numbers and where this name is headed next, right after this.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money Podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks ending the day just about flat. The Dow on a three-day losing streak, but down just 0.1% today. The S&P gaining about 5 points, and the Nasdaq up about 0.25%. Intel dropping more than 7% after revealing a $7 billion operating loss for its foundry business in 2023. Taiwan Semi recovering from early losses after the chipmaker said it suffered no critical damage from the 7.4 magnitude earthquake that hit the region. Meantime, shares of Levi Strauss higher after hours. The company beating on top and bottom lines and raising guidance. The company saying it is seeing strength in loose-fitting jeans for both men and women. Guy, they're back.
Oh, stop.
A 40% in Q1. And do not miss the CNBC exclusive interview with Levi Strauss President and CEO Michelle Gass. That's tonight, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Last Call. Meantime, first quarter sales numbers from Ford driving the stock higher today. The shares up nearly 3%. Let's go to CNBC's Phil LeBeau, who's got all the details. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Melissa, this is validation for some of the moves that Ford made, especially when it comes to hybrids and with EVs. We'll explain that in just a little bit. Take a look at shares of Ford, as you mentioned, up about 3% today after the company reported Q1 sales increasing 6.8%. That's Q1 sales here in the United States. In terms of the breakdown, ICE vehicles up 2.6%, but look at the growth in hybrids and in EVs, up 42 and 86% respectively. And when you look at the EV market, Ford is now into the third position after Tesla, which still dominates with more than 50% market share. There you see Hyundai, Kia, Genesis would be in there as well. And then you see Ford, and that is a testament to the decision that was made in February to slash prices on the Mustang Mach-E. Now, we'll find out what the impact is in terms of how much more it weighs on the bottom line, the greater the losses we might expect within the EV division in a couple of weeks, and they report their earnings. But the bottom line is this. Consumers responded, and the Mustang Mach-E, I think it was the third or fourth best-selling EV in the quarter for the entire industry. And that's a testament, again, to the demand that is out there when you slash prices and put it at a price point where people are saying, yeah, I'm interested in this. Quickly take a look at shares of Ford, Hyundai, Tesla. You can see what kind of quarter it's been. Tesla, not a surprise there. By the way, EVs, that market share, Melissa, really hasn't changed year over year. 7.1%. By the way, hybrids, 10.1% market share. It continues to grow, and the domination there is with Toyota. We'll have more on that tomorrow, a breakdown on who's leading when it comes to hybrids.
Yeah, and on that chart, Phil, it looked like Hyundai was a market share loser where Ford was gaining the share, because Tesla looked kind of stable.
Hyundai actually gained some market share within EVs. They went up slightly, and you see just a little bit of erosion for Tesla. Really, where Ford was gaining it was basically from everybody else. But they jumped from like 4.5% market share up to 7.5%.
Wow, big jump. Phil, thank you. Phil LeBeau.
You bet.
We asked a question the other night when we were talking about Tesla in the context of making decisions about the EV market, foreseeing the drop in demand or the softening demand for EVs. And we asked, who got it right? Can we say now that Ford got it right?
Well, it's still an internal combustion engine story.
Yes, yes.
Without question. Mm-hmm. Did they get it right? They're more right than they've been. I think they've turned the corner. But the question is, in terms of the stock, what do you do here? So the report, I think, on April 24th, look, the momentum's behind you now. I mean, there's a very good chance you could sort of levitate up to that level we saw last July of about $15 or so. And then I think all bets are off once earnings is released. But I think you ride the wave right now.
I think there's a ton of momentum, and we've already seen it. And we've seen Ford underperform GM by 30% over the last 6 months. It's fascinating that we could be having a conversation. Did Ford get it right? When in fact, you know, we've brought them up over and over the last, you know, well, many years, but I would say even over the last 6 to 9 months, where the company themselves have come forward and said, actually, we have some work to do, and we're going to make some adjustments in terms of our efficiencies. But there's no question in terms of the appeal of the F-150 and where that appeal exists in EV land. So I'm long Ford, I'm long GM, I'm longer GM, but I think Ford can outperform.
Coming up, a check on some recent IPOs, all of which posted losses today, what the options market is saying about where these big movers could be headed next. Plus, billionaire investor David Einhorn saying value investing is dead. At Sohn Conference, he said this. Where he's putting his money and why, right after this.
We own a lot more gold than just the GLD. We own physical bars as well.
Why so?
So gold is a very large position for us.
Why have you made it so large?
Well, because I think that there's a problem with the overall monetary and fiscal policies of the country, and that both policies are systemically too loose. I think the deficits are ultimately a real problem, and I think that this is a way to hedge the risk of something, you know, not so good happening.
That was Greenlight Capital's David Einhorn speaking with Scott Wapner earlier on CNBC's Power Lunch. The noted investor doubling down on his gold position as a hedge against a potential market downturn. The precious metal, meantime, making another high, record high in today's session, settling above $2,300. Wow.
So when you hear people like him say it, and then Stan Druckenmiller about February 15th or so talked about his foray into gold miners and say, wait a second, it's not just hacks like me. Tim is not a hack talking about this. I mean, they all are seeing the same thing. So the gold miners are starting to catch up. There's a lot of room left.
You have never liked gold.
No, I've never liked gold. It's been interesting, though, to see, you know, some of the sort of gold luster was taken away by Bitcoin, which actually in this last little run has had, you know, in the last, I don't know, just week, a terrible run. I would have thought it would have done better in this scenario. We'll see if digital gold ultimately has a place.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I'd say whatever the percentage is, but I bet it's north of 25 and less than 50% of the Bitcoin interest is for all the same reasons people want to own gold. What's interesting about the gold move is it's come without really any real institutional support outside of the smart guys like Mr. Einhorn and folks. And I think that's part of the story now. I think it's been all central bank buying. And you can look at gold flows, by the way, folks. You can look and you can see where they go, you know, where they are coming from and going to. And I just feel like this trade, I understand historically, this is the wrong time to buy gold after these kinds of spikes, except for the fact that I think this time is different.
Central banks buying at the expense of Treasuries at the expense of instead of
central banks diversifying for sure. And there's no question that this is some of the biggest central banks in the world, but some of the smallest as well. And I just feel like this is a view that people are expecting some kind of change, but that political upheaval is something people are fearful of.
Yeah, it's interesting. You guys have spent a lot of time, I think, over the last year or two talking about central banks buying gold, and you think about where it is and just the relentless buying that we've seen of late. And then you see this move that we've seen in Bitcoin, you know, it nearly doubled, I think, from its high or from its lows just a few months ago. And you say to yourself, you look at the market cap of that and you think about what Tim just said, for most of the reasons that people are buying Bitcoin are not too different than gold. You say to yourself, okay, you'd love to see a technical pullback in Bitcoin, maybe back towards 50,000. There seems to be an air pocket below 60 down that level or something. And then you can start diversifying away against your calamity trade, because that's really what you're doing in a way. So to me, I think Bitcoin looks interesting, but at much lower levels below 60,000.
All right. Coming up, some recent debuts helping defrost the IPO market, how some high profile names have been holding up, including the big swings out of Trump's media stock, and how options traders are handling all the action. More Fast Money's next. Welcome back to Fast Money. The recent freeze on the IPO market seems to be thawing out, with a number of high-profile names going public. AI play Astera Labs in its debut, nearly doubling since hitting the market less than 2 weeks ago. Reddit, another big name, making a splash since its debut. The social media stock up nearly 40% since going public. Trump's media company, on the other hand, continuing its wild swings, down another 5% today, now in the red since de-SPACing. Those big swings giving options traders something to bite into. Mike Coe has the action. Hey, Mike.
Yeah, so DJT is pretty remarkable when you take a look at the options activity. It traded 20% above its average, already very elevated options volume. Remarkable for a company that isn't really a company yet. Calls outpaced puts, and oftentimes that means that there's bullish sentiment, but that isn't actually the case here, because almost all of the calls that traded, and the five most active calls were all very deeply in the money. The most active of those were the January 25, 15 strike calls, which are obviously very deep in the money. What is going on here and what is actually happening is that this is mostly institutional flow. This stock is very hard to borrow. So if you want to be short the stock, it is difficult to short it. So people are using options instead, and that's what a lot of this institutional flow is about. This is efforts to take short bets on DJT going out in time.
I'm surprised institutions would even bother playing the options market in this name, Mike. Is that surprising to you at all?
Well, I mean, consider the size. I mean, there, you know, if you wanted to make a bearish bet on something, and some of these bets are pretty big. I mean, 8,600 of those calls traded. So that's 860,000 shares worth. That's not an inconsequential amount. And some of the other most active contracts, like the 30 strike calls, let's see, for June, those traded about 4,200 times. The 20 strike calls going out to 2025, that was also about 4,000 contracts. So these aren't small bets. And, you know, if you're going to try to make a bearish bet on something like this, options is the way to do it. But you got to find a way to short it.
Right.
And that's hard to do on a hard stock.
Mike, thanks. Mike Coe. Karen?
Yeah.
Have you tempted you yet?
Well, I was curious. So I called yesterday. All right. How much is it to short? 300% now.
Oh, so it's come down.
Yeah, no, it was kind of, it was 130% the other day. And I was like, wait, so if I shorted for a full year, I lose money no matter where it trades? And they said, yes. So this is even worse. But obviously, people only borrow it for a short amount of time. I think they're hoping for a lockup to be waived. Mm-hmm. And so supply to come on the market.
Right. But we mentioned Reddit. Are you surprised that Reddit is trading higher?
I'm surprised. It's not trading particularly well. And I just say in the last hour, they had the Klaviyo CEO. This is a company that went public at $30, I think late last year or so. And this is a tech stock, and it was hotly anticipated. People wanted to see how this one was going to do, $6.5 billion market cap or so. And it spent most of its time as a publicly traded company below its IPO price. So I just think that's kind of interesting. It's still losing money on a GAAP basis. There's growing sales, maybe, 28, 29% a year for the next couple of years. And it's an interesting company. I'm sure it's a very good company. Doesn't say a lot for demand for these sorts of issues right now. Yep.
Up next, final trades. Time for the final trade, Tim.
Just get it out. Not a lot of time. Ford Motor Company into earnings.
Karen.
Yeah, still not a lot of time. Yeah, next week, banks, Citigroup.
Even less time, Dan.
You want to protect your Citigroup, XLF puts like Dollar Tree.
Guy.
We actually do have time.
Yeah, we do. Yeah,
slow down. Going to the Ranger game with his daughter. I think that's beautiful.
Very, yeah. Sky. She's all dressed up, too, in Ranger.
Alcoa, double A.
All right. Thanks for watching MCO. Fast. Mad Money with Tim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.